This podcast is part of the London Business School series, Inside the Global Economy, in which leading experts explore what is really going on in the global economy today.
I'm Linda Yu, and thank you for joining me for Inside the Global Economy. In this podcast, we are going to look inside what's happening in the Chinese economy. We'll be focused on new consumer brands and businesses, some of the upcoming changes and reforms that's happening within the Chinese business sector. And I'm joined by two superb guests who are going to talk us through all of these issues in the next few moments. So let me first welcome David Wei. He's the executive chairman and founder of Vision Knight Capital. He was the CEO of Alibaba Limited. Alibaba is a global leading e-commerce company, and David successfully led the listing of Alibaba Limited on the Hong Kong Stock Exchange in 2007. In the studio with me is Matthew Roos. He's the chief executive of the China-Britain Business Council. He's been in post since 2017, after 26 years in the British Foreign and Commonwealth Office, working as a career diplomat, most recently as British Consul General in Guangzhou, China. The CBBC includes some of the UK's largest and most established companies, as well as leading Chinese firms. Welcome to you both. David, I'm going to kick off with you. How would you describe the business environment in China right now?
Well, the high-growth golden era for China's economy is gone. However, we are very confident we will come a silver era of economic growth. Silver is not as good, gold, but not too bad. So what's the driving forces behind it? So on the consumer side, I said there are two sectors, healthcare and education, completely resilient to any possible economic downturn. And on the business side, B2B or enterprise service become more and more important, because when the economy is growing so fast and the top line of every business is growing like 30-40% a year on year, the entrepreneurs don't care much about efficiency improvement. And a B2B enterprise service is all about efficiency improvement. We have the feelings that most entrepreneurs, business people, getting more and more interested in enterprise service. So these are two big ones. And in general, we should not underestimate a new driving force, which is coming from the millennial population, people who were born between 1995 to 2005. They enjoy a very unique feature, which in the entire human being history has never experienced. I call it, in my opinion, I call it one child policy 2.0 version. Because they are not just one child under one child, their parents are one child. So which means they will inherit probably the strongest personal balance sheet forever. Each one-child policy 2.0 version kid, their parents, their grandparents will give them three pieces of property, mortgage-free. And once they get married, the couple, the millennial couple, will have six pieces of property without mortgage. So very strong personal balance sheet. Which what we're already seeing, last couple of years, this millennial population getting to market to spend, they spend 2x or 3x of the same spending power for those people who were born after 1980 or 85 at their age. So they are the first generation in China who can live on credit, who will spend on credit, but they were not going to go bankrupt because they are inheriting a very strong personal balance sheet. So these are driving force. Another driving force before I finish is the second child policy released about 3 years ago. Last year, the overall birth rate was quite disappointing. It's between 14 to 15 million new babies. That didn't give us a jump at all. However, the mix of new babies started to change. Last year, among the 14, 15 million new babies, 7.5 million are the second child. And a second child family normally is wealthier than the families may not afford the second child. And the same couple who have their second child, their household income is better than the time than when they have their first child. So most of my friends around me, when they have a second child, they're considering to buy a bigger car, to buy a bigger apartment with an extra bedroom. So think about 3-4 years ahead from now, we should expect at least 30 million families with second child, and we should expect about 100 million millennial population coming to the new spending power with much stronger spending power. So I think these are the driving forces for us to welcome a silver era of consumption growth in China 3 to 4 years from now.
Thank you, David. Matthew, what's your view of the business environment in China, speaking more from a British business perspective?
Well, certainly David's right to say that the golden era of high growth is over, and we've seen that very clearly since the global financial crash in 2008. For a number of years, the Chinese system has kept momentum going by high levels of borrowing, particularly at local government and state-owned enterprises. But that's not really a sustainable approach for the long term, given the risks that it generates for the financial system. And what we're seeing now is the leadership taking a very deliberate decision to open the system up more and to allow more foreign competition, including in previously sensitive areas like financial services. Because it's well known that competition from overseas brings in new ideas, new talents, helps to drive up productivity in a way which is really essential. And that's an opportunity which foreign firms, including CBC's members, have to grasp with enthusiasm and gusto. I think it's true, particularly in the services sector, but we see it in consumer industries as well, as David has described. We have this whole new generation, the millennial generation, who are keen as never before to use their new spending power to buy foreign goods. But getting your goods to market in China, particularly making use of the huge boom in e-commerce, is a challenge for some foreign businesses. And a little basic hand-holding and education in how to, you know, do your due diligence really does pay dividends. So lots of opportunities if you know how to get them.
So what are some of these specific opportunities for British businesses? Because there's always this perception that China hasn't opened, especially around services. So it'd be interesting to hear which sectors have opened more. Sorry, Matthew, and then I'll come to you, David, on that.
So we see particularly in the consumer sector, huge opportunities opening up for foreign firms to sell direct to consumers. Apparel, food and drink are doing very well indeed. In services, education, healthcare, as has been mentioned. And tourism is a big one that's sometimes overlooked because there's no physical movement of goods. It's the buyer who actually moves. But that's a hugely growing one for people who know how to target the Chinese audience.
But not so much financial services or insurance?
Financial services, particularly important for UK, given the strength of the City of London. And there you're looking at a broad range of opportunities. Since President Xi's Boao Forum speech last year, 2018, he signalled very strongly that the domestic financial services market would be opening up. And since roughly then, we've seen foreign firms like HSBC and UBS be able to come in with majority foreign-owned, fully licensed securities businesses. It's the same's happening in insurance with Allianz and Willis, Standard & Poor Global for credit ratings. So foreign companies are beginning to be able to get hold of these opportunities. The big unknown is how far domestic banking will be opened up. It's still true that less than 2% of the Chinese domestic banking market is foreign-owned. So there's a long way to go. But City of London firms are well positioned to move that forward.
Mm. David, you wanted to come in there in terms of the foreign competition in Chinese markets?
Yeah, I want to highlight a couple of things. Number one, I think education. I have sent two of my boys to study in the UK, but not the other way around. We're expecting to see more British schools in China, which can get more population, more young kids to enjoy the UK education. And we expect that should be opening up more. At the moment, British schools or international schools in China can only take international students. So that's another reform we're expecting. On financial sectors, I think insurance, banking have been opened up for a couple of decades and highly competitive. The local banks, the local insurers are doing pretty well. I think the biggest opportunity will be asset management. Asset management is very new, even with among the Chinese local financial institutions. So I think the British asset management expertise and global network to offer global products to Chinese high net wealth family, that's a lot. Last but not least, we need to remind that the two stock exchanges, London and Shanghai, A few months ago, London-Shanghai Link has been established but not been properly promoted. And that's also fundamental, which means a European-UK investor can get access to the Chinese capital market much easier. And the other way around, Chinese investors, in particular institutional investors, they need to diversify their portfolio outside China. And the Shanghai-London Link will be a fundamental foundation to make that happen.
Before I move on to thinking about some of the regulatory changes, Matthew, I just wanted to get your take on, does this opening up over the past year mean that it is a new era in terms of foreign services competition in China? Traditionally, this is an area where there has been, I think, barriers to foreign firms, especially in the services sector, broadly speaking. Has that changed? Is that changing?
I think the social momentum behind this has been building for at least 10 years. Specifically in financial services, there is some skepticism as to how far the Chinese leadership is willing to respond to this building pressure. Vested interests are strong. Let's be candid about that point. But the point I've made earlier about foreign competition helping to drive up standards and thereby to increase the competitiveness and resilience of Chinese businesses for the long term is an important one, which is recognized. And as to how far it will go, well, we will see over time. I think there is already responsiveness to some of the issues that foreign banks are raising, particularly around the rules on capital requirements for establishing new businesses. Foreign banks naturally tend to hold most of their assets outside China. Inside China, they have an asset-light model, if you like, and that can make it difficult sometimes for them to compete on a level playing field when it comes to winning new licenses. And my summary would be that where the headline regulation will often be pretty good and pretty well implemented, it's those subsidiary issues, more cultural issues, more about the way that regulations are interpreted in practice, that are the ones that need to be the subject of ongoing conversations.
Mm. David, in terms of private equity, as well as just more broadly, venture capital, this kind of sector, how much is foreign competition an issue?
Before I address the venture capital and private equity, just some additional comments about regulatory evolution. Prior to my career running Alibaba.com, I actually was CFO, then CEO for a British business, British retailer called B&Q. I have experienced the deregulation in the retail service sector. When I was CFO, actually, we cannot hold majority ownership of a retailer in China as a foreign business. And we need to go through store-by-store license approval, even not city-by-city. And within 5 to 6 years, we have seen that has been changed. A foreign business can own 100% of a retailer in China, and you don't need to go to Beijing MOFTEC for approval. The local city level can give you approval and treat it as a local retailer. So my point is we have experienced some service sectors being opened up, and I agree with Matthew that it's about a little bit of timing. It's about the national law and also these local regional execution. It will happen. The retail opened up much earlier, and we expect financial sectors to be opened gradually because it's a more sensitive sector, to be honest. Then back to the private equity and venture capital industry. Honestly, about 15 years ago, this kind of industry does not exist at all. So it's the companies like venture capitalists like Sequoia from the US, from Silicon Valley, and KKR, Blackstone, these big names bring this concept into China. And thank you for this venture capitalist. Otherwise, we would not expect the success of Alibaba.com today, as well as other Chinese internet giants. Each one of them has been empowered and backed by those foreign global venture capitalists or private equity firms. Then the local, like the retail industry, the local players learn very fast, very fast. Now we have over 10,000 licensed venture capital firms or private equity firms in China. The total capital every year deployed in China now is the local parties. The local money is bigger than US dollar investment. But that doesn't mean the US dollar has any restrictions at all. The key things, the concept was introduced by foreign players, international players, and now the question is, what's the differentiated strategy these international venture capitalists or private can offer. Because dollar is dollar, RMB is RMB. There's no difference between the money. So I think the challenge is now, this industry is not restricted at all to foreign players in China from day one. It's the local players catching up. Now the challenge is to the international players how to differentiate themselves by just introducing the capital. Either their technology or their global network can help. So I think that industry, private equity venture capital industry, no restriction from day one, and we didn't expect anything needs to be further opened up. I think the question is on the business side, under the venture capitalist, the private equity firm side, what we can offer into China.
Interesting. I want to move on to this idea of reform that could support China's business environment as China grows its economy to try and make its population, you know, prosperous. The whole sort of big challenges around that, obviously the whole growing rich debate, which is very, very challenging for any country. But and China's obviously come a long way. So Matthew, I'll start with you. What kind of regulatory changes do you think China needs to undertake to achieve its aim of overcoming the middle-income country trap and becoming prosperous?
For me, allowing access to foreign firms which will drive up standards across the board is critically important. It's easy to see how that works when you talk in the specific context of financial services. But I think it's true also for the healthcare sectors, where foreign providers are beginning to move in and provide not just pharma, but clinical services as well. It's true in education, where there are understandable restrictions, because after all, the two social systems are very, very different. But where certainly UK firms, UK schools and colleges, who tap into a really rich heritage and tradition, are able to provide support with things like curriculum reform, provision of materials, teacher training, vocational training. These sorts of things are areas where bringing in new talent, new skills, new ideas are probably much more important than regulatory reform. And in the consumer sector, I would say it is all about protection of intellectual property. China is a first-to-file jurisdiction. It's if you register a name first, you have exclusive rights to it. And that makes it difficult to protect foreign brands against bad faith registrations sometimes. There are important steps underway. The intellectual property law itself has been through several revisions. Intellectual property specialist IP courts have been set up in some of the regional centres. There is now an IP tribunal within the Supreme Court. But all that needs support from foreign experts, technical assistance, I think, to legislators, to the judiciary, to administrators across the piece is really important to ensure that not only we get good judgments which protect foreign brands, you know, generally the quality of judgments is pretty high, but we also need enforcement. We need effective enforcement of those judicial decisions to give foreign businesses the confidence to trade and to make the most of the opportunities.
Thank you. David, same question to you. What kinds of reforms do you think China needs to do to realize the potential of these new markets that you've described to help drive domestic demand that could be one of the ways in which China can become a prosperous country in the coming years? Certainly, that's one of the goals of the world's second biggest economy, is to become prosperous, overcome this middle income trap.
I mentioned earlier that the millennial population will inherit probably the strongest personal balance sheet ever in human beings' history. I try to highlight another thing which mostly ignored by the external world outside China is Chinese government probably also has the strongest balance sheet compared to other governments in the world. I agree with Matthew, it's a little bit over-leveraged on debt level, local regional government side. However, if you look at asset side, land, most land are still owned by the government in China. And SOE, state-owned enterprise, also trillion dollars valuation in their equity. Then the reform, I think, in my opinion, should hit these two asset sides. So land reform to give a real freehold land ownership, not just land use rights, 70 years, 40 years, 50 years, to the people living in the city, but also give land use rights or ownership to farmers. That will release huge wealth from the land. Number two is further selling down the equities owned by the state-owned enterprises, not just selling down equities. I think the challenge today is not give foreign business a level playground, but also we expect to give a level fair playground to the private sector. The key challenge is the state-owned sector is too powerful. So on one hand, to release more equity value from the state-owned enterprises, on the other side, to reduce their influence in the overall economic environment in China. So these two biggest reforms we're expecting will continue to make China a very prosperous, maybe from silver era back to golden era again.
Finally, what is the biggest misconception about business in China? David, I'll start with you.
Yeah, I'm in the States now. A lot of business people ask me, does China do not welcome foreign capital anymore? I say the answer is no, definitely not. We are running US dollar fund as well as RMB fund. In the last 12 to 24 months, most entrepreneurs who wish to take our investment, they wish to take a US dollar instead of RMB. And I'm asking why? Well, China holding the largest foreign reserve, and it's challenging at the moment. So that's why the local regional government officials have been given KPIs again to attract foreign investment. Although foreign investment has not been in that much favor when I was running BNQ like 15 years ago, but there is a big deception that China doesn't need foreign capital or foreign capital will be discriminated. I think it's not the answer from the government side and it's not the answer from the business community at all.
Thank you. Same question to you, Matthew. Biggest misconception about business in China?
It's quite a simplistic point, but it's one that I'm going to make anyway because it is so important. And that's about the importance of trust and good relationships amongst CBBC's clients and members. We're talking about a very diverse group of companies with different levels of experience. But many come to China for the first time thinking it's big and far off and scary and culturally very different. And somebody must be out there wanting to get you and to exploit you, to steal your intellectual property, as we've said already. And that's a big concern. But there are simple things that you can do to address these risks. And the most important of all is to focus on finding a good partner with whom you can build that trusting relationship. Because in a Chinese business context, relationships are absolutely essential. And if you've got the quality of your conversations right, then there's a very promising market indeed for you to tap into.
Mm. Well, I'm just going to share one cultural thing that I thought might just tie off this importance of understanding business in China a little bit, which is there's understanding how to do business in China is about relationships and understanding things like what is a Chinese no might be useful. So David, you may have heard this before. Matthew, I think, is nodding along at the moment. But if a Chinese business person says yes, she means maybe. If she says maybe, she means no. If she says no, she's not a Chinese business person.
That's very true.
Correct. Very true. Very true. We always give face, so we will not do saying no face to face. So give you some hope in a conversation.
Leave something on the table to come back to on that relationship. Absolutely fantastic discussion from the both of you. Such great insights. Thank you very much to my guests for joining me on this London Business School podcast, to David Wei, Executive Chairman and Founder of Vision Knight Capital and the former CEO of Alibaba Limited, and Matthew Roos in the studio here with me, the Chief Executive of the China-Britain Business Council and a former career diplomat for the British government. Thank you both very much indeed.
This was a London Business School podcast, bringing you fresh insights and ideas from London Business School's experts. To listen and read more, visit www.london.edu.